desire to create is one of the deepest yearnings of the human soul. We each have an inherent wish to create something that did not exist before. The more you trust and rely upon the Spirit, the greater your capacity to create.
I'm Nancy Hansen, and this is Everything Creative. This program explores a wide range of creative ideas, talents, and experiences through interviews and group discussions.
Welcome back to Everything Creative. My name is Rich Sutton. I'm here with Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and it's good to have you with us today. So tell me about yourself and your background.
Well, if you want to know everything, that will take quite a bit of time. I was raised in Idaho with 8 brothers and sisters, and I'm the oldest of 9. My parents are both deaf, and my siblings are also deaf. Their levels of hearing are various. Some can hear more than others, but they're all deaf. I was not raised with all of my brothers and sisters. By the time I went to Gallaudet University, my youngest 4 siblings were only 5, 3, and 1, and the youngest wasn't even born yet. In fact, my youngest sibling was born my junior year at Gallaudet. Even though I didn't have a chance to live with them while I was growing up, we did get a chance to see each other often. Anyway, I went to Gallaudet University my entire college career, and then I graduated. I worked for a while in Washington, D.C., and then I moved to Texas and worked at a small community college for the deaf called Southwest Collegiate Institute for the Deaf. I worked there for 3 years, and during my time there, I met my husband. We started dating, and a year later, we got married in the Salt Lake Temple. Then I began teaching ASL. I taught ASL for 23 years and retired 2 years ago. During those 23 years, I taught ASL to hearing and deaf students. Deaf students would typically enroll in the advanced level ASL courses. I also taught English to the deaf. I've lived in Utah for about 22 years now, and today my husband and I are celebrating our 21st wedding anniversary.
Wow, 21 years. That's awesome.
I have 3 deaf children. The oldest is a daughter, and she's 13. And then my son, he's 12. And the youngest is a daughter, and she's almost 11.
Wow, that's great. So you taught for 23 years, and man, that's a long time. So from your experience, did you prefer teaching ASL or did you prefer English?
I prefer teaching ASL for several reasons. Primarily because it is my native language and I love and enjoy sign language. Also, my ASL students were usually at the same level of signing ability and they could all progress together. However, my experience teaching English was different because the English abilities of all the deaf students were so varied and I had to adapt my lesson and find new materials that could meet each of their individual needs. I usually taught remedial English, so it was an experience that was always changing. For a few years, I taught English 101 and was able to follow the university syllabus. That was sometimes difficult given the students' varied English abilities, but I enjoyed it. I always wondered if it was worth it after the first semester, though.
That's true. So, okay, you taught hearing students ASL. And what are some of the experiences you've had with your students who probably have not had that much experience with ASL or deafness, and then they meet you as your teacher and maybe a deaf person for the first time? What are some experiences you've had with that?
Well, most of the time it was just fine. However, it's important that I as a teacher set the right classroom environment from the first day. This includes that I wouldn't talk but only sign and some gesturing and writing on the chalkboard. It was kind of a slow, repetitive process, but they eventually started to grasp the concepts. Sometimes after class, a few students would come up and communicate with me by writing notes and asking me whether I was hearing or deaf, and I would tell them that, yes, I'm deaf. I can't think of a time when I had a real serious problem, but I had many things that have surprised me, but no real problems.
I can only imagine the shock of your students as you're not talking to them but using your hands. And it just must have been, you know, something very hard for them at first, but something maybe they eventually got used to.
A person always learns faster from not using your voice in class. One thing my students usually did get away with is when they would whisper in class. Sometimes I caught them, but usually I couldn't see what they were doing, or I would just ignore it because it wasn't worth my time to worry about it. I figured it was their choice, and if they wanted to learn, then the best way was to work with each other by not talking. Also, when the time came to take a test, they would be caught if they weren't prepared ahead of time. Their performance would show it. I recall a few problems I had, one in particular with a girl from Japan who took my class. She was a very good signer, but she couldn't read English very well. And because of that, she couldn't answer the questions on the test. So I had to try a different approach in testing her knowledge of ASL without using English. And that was a challenge. Another problem I encountered was with a boy who had a learning disability. He could sign just fine, but he could not write English, so we had to make some adaptations for him. I was never bored with teaching. It's always been a pleasure.
Those are some great experiences. I kind of want to shift and talk about a new topic. We've talked about when you taught ASL, but when did you start translating from English to ASL? What were some of your experiences during that translation process?
Well, I probably started when I was in high school. Not that I was formally translating them, but I would watch the interpreters, knowing beforehand what the English sentence or phrase was, and I would think of a way that the sentence or phrase could have been translated maybe different or better. I didn't use interpreters much while I was in college, so I didn't really think about it much then. But when I started to translate the Book of Mormon, which I was first called in 1989, I already knew how to do ASL gloss. And during my early translation work on the Book of Mormon, I realized that glossing the translation would be difficult. I started out glossing the translation by hand and then giving it to a friend to type it out on the computer. But that caused too many problems because the lines on my handwritten gloss and her type gloss wouldn't always match up. So I ended up just handwriting my gloss and keeping it in a linear fashion. I was initially called in 1989, but because of some challenges, we really didn't get started until about 1994. No, maybe it was 93. So there was a 4-year period that I struggled and modified and figured out what I was doing. During that time, I worked with Jack Rose in the Temple translation, and that helped me a lot in my scripture translation work. Working with Jack Rose at that time was great because he was involved with translation work previously, and he had a lot of ideas and a lot of experience that he shared with me, and I learned from him. Having all that experience has really helped me, and we finally started to work on the ASL translation of the Book of Mormon. I was able to look at all what each verse meant in English and think about how to translate that in ASL, and then write it in a gloss format. So my formal translation really began in about 1991 or 1992.
Wow. If you're just joining us, this is the Mormon Channel and Everything Creative, and I'm Rich Sutton, and I'm here interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and she's deaf, and Kim Day will be interpreting for her. So I'd love for you to share with us some stories or experiences, anything that you can think of that happened during your translation of the Book of Mormon that maybe gave you a different perspective.
Well, there were a few things. For example, translating is obviously a difficult process, and it's different than interpreting. One thing I liked about translating is that I was able to get my own pace and follow my own natural speed of the language, and which is much different than interpreting, where sometimes you have to hurry to match the pace of the speaker. However, Temple translation was an exception to that because you had to translate and then match the timing of all the audio. With translating the Book of Mormon, however, there was no audio involved and no timing, so I was able to follow my own pace and the natural rhythm of ASL, and I really enjoyed that. There are also some cultural things that I had to take into account as I was translating. For example, say there was a phrase in Joseph Smith history where Joseph Smith writes, "Moroni called me by name." Well, the first problem is that in ASL you don't have passive voice like English does. Well, maybe that isn't a good example of passive voice, but anyway, I had to figure out why Moroni called Joseph by name. Within deaf culture, we do not use a person's name usually to get their attention. We would wave at them to get their attention. And unless they're really far away or they're not paying attention, we might ask somebody else to get their attention. Or we'd say, "Bob, you know, could you get his attention to look at me? But we would never say Bob. So now with Moroni calling Joseph Smith by name, I had to figure out, well, how would a deaf people call each other and combine it with what it literally says in the English? And knowing that deaf people call each other by waving, or I wanted to keep that translation as literal as possible without adding a lot of cultural translation. So I said, he spoke my name. And then I added a wave, and that seemed to work.
Yeah, that makes much more sense.
I did that to show that he said the name in order to call on him. That was one experience I had, but there were several others that I really had to work hard to make sure the translation was literal and yet culturally understandable. One of my biggest concerns was the use of space. For example, when the Book of Mormon makes a reference of going to Zarahemla, where do I point for Zarahemla? Is it north, south, east, west? I had no idea. The Book of Mormon really doesn't give directional references. Well, sometimes it does say a north or a south, but most of the time it doesn't. So I had to use a seminary map. It wasn't exactly the best visual aid, but it gave us a reference for where we could point to a city like Ammonihah or Mulek. And I struggled with the names of people and even the height of people. I just assumed that for this purpose that they were all the same height. So I had to visually establish cities and people by using role shifting and then trying to converse between the people. As an example, whenever a person was speaking to the Lord, they always spoke to the right. And when the Lord would speak to somebody, he would always look down from the left.
Wow. So, you know, the really interesting thing for me is that it took you 10 years to finish the translation of the Book of Mormon. Is that right?
Actually, 11.
Wow. So 11 years to finish it. So during that time, when you were working on the translation, you had two children born, right?
I had three children during that time.
Three. Wow. So you had all three of your children born while you were doing the translation of the Book of Mormon. How were you able to make all that work?
Well, that was one of the reasons why it took so long to finish. The first 4 years, I didn't get a lot done. My focus first shifted to the temple translation. Then my focus shifted to graduate school, and that lasted till 1993. But it was during that time that I started to understand my role as a translator and how I was going to accomplish that. Also during that time, I had a new supervisor, Terry Morier, assigned to me from the translation department. And he really helped me out tremendously. It made a difference that when we were put into the right place and the right department and had the right supervisor. He worked with deaf people before and he knew my father, so that helped move the work forward. We finally started filming in 1994, and from that point forward, the work progressed. My first child was born in 1995, and I also started a full-time job that same year. So it took a little longer than I thought to completely focus on the translation of the Book of Mormon. There were times when I was completely focused on the work for a few months, and then I would switch to something else, and then I'd come back to the Book of Mormon, and then I'd have another baby, and then I would come back to translating. This was the progress, you know, this was the process, and we struggled during the entire time. Between all three of my children, work, and everything else, the translation was finally completed during the Christmas season of the year 2000. From January of 1989 until then was almost exactly 11 years.
That's so interesting to me. So, okay, so during those 11 years, did you completely translate it before you filmed it? Or did you translate a portion and then film that portion and so on like that until you finished? Or what was the process?
Well, we tried to translate it all and have it all done before we started filming, but that was just too much. In hindsight, I guess we could have done it, but it would have been too much. We had to translate a portion and then film it, and we kept going that way until it was done. There were also other factors. First Nephi, for example, went great, and I was ready to go and had it memorized, and the filming went really well. But as the project progressed, I was under more time constraints, and then I would have to rush to meet the deadlines. There were times that in order to meet the deadline, I would finish translating the night before we filmed. The problem was then, too, that the filming wouldn't go well and it would take longer. It's also hard to describe facial expressions in ASL in a written form. So I simply had to memorize the facial expressions that went along with what the written translation was. And that's how we did it.
Wow, that's great. Well, if you're just joining us, this is Everything Creative on the Mormon Channel, and I'm Rich Sutton, and I'm here interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and she's deaf, and Kim Day is interpreting for her. Just a follow-up question, did you guys use a teleprompter during the filming process, or how did that work?
Oh, yes, we had three cameras, one in the center and one on each side. And each of the three cameras had a teleprompter, so I could see the teleprompter when I would shift from side to side. If I were to do it all again, I would like to have 9 teleprompters.
Wow.
3 in the center, 1 at eye level, 1 above and below, and then 3 on the right side, eye level, above and below, and 3 on the left side, 1 at eye level, 1 above and below. Because with that setup, then when I could shift, I could be different characters and look where I wanted and not be so limited. It would be nice to have the flexibility to look wherever I needed to do. But at that time, we only had 3 cameras.
Wow. It's just so fascinating to me to hear that. Okay, so you mentioned that before you really got started in 1989 to about 1993, you began to understand really what you were supposed to do. I guess my question is, what specifically did you learn that helped you in that process?
I think what I learned was the process of what I was going to be doing. I really felt like we were trying to reinvent the wheel. We tried to set up a committee of translators. We tried sign writing, which I think is a cool piece of technology, but it was too new at the time. So finally, we went back to the traditional way of translating, and we just kept it basic. We began to ask Terry, our supervisor, what we were supposed to do and what the processes that other languages followed. And he told us step by step, so we followed that process and things got a lot better after that. Prior to that time, it seemed like we were given the project and then just left alone and we were on our own. We really struggled at first because we weren't sure what to do, but after we knew what we were supposed to do, it got better and easier. One realization was that I had to become the head translator. This meant that I would do all of the translating and not try to have a committee. There really is not just one right way to translate. Everybody has their own style, but it was decided that I would be the translator. It was an interesting process, all in all.
Okay, so now that you're done with the project and you're able to look back on the project, what's your experience like when you're watching the DVD and you see yourself?
Oh, I still can't watch myself. When I read the Book of Mormon, I still find myself retranslating it in my head. It's been 9 years and I'm still translating it. Even with the other books of scriptures that I read, like the Doctrine and Covenants, or for example, now I'm reading the Pearl of Great Price, and I end up reading the scriptures and then I think, how would I translate that verse? Then I find myself translating it and signing the scripture back to myself. But anyway, back to your question, maybe I have not tried to watch myself enough, and maybe now I could begin to watch myself and not feel funny about it. I would definitely see things that I would want to change, and I'm sure I could find facial expressions or different things that I could do better.
It's funny because I always notice that when I watch myself signing, I'm always criticizing myself. I guess just wondering if you did the same.
If people ask me if I am content with my translation, I would say that I'm about 90% satisfied. Even though it's not perfect, translating is really hard, and it's hard to match the English exactly. So the Book of Mormon in English is the most correct book in the world, and I tried to keep as close as I could to the English, and I feel good because I knew that the Spirit was there helping us. I know that it was not my work, but it was the Spirit's work. There are many things that I could have done better or could have done by myself, but there are a few places where it could have been better, but overall, I'm very satisfied.
If you're just joining us, we'd like to welcome you to the Mormon Channel and Everything Creative. And I'm Rich Sutton. I'm interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, who is deaf, and Kim Day is here translating for her. I just feel really touched right now because I heard the testimony from the translator of the Book of Mormon in ASL, and I just want to thank you for sharing that with us. Kind of on a personal note, I know that my mom loves the Book of Mormon in ASL, and she's able to watch it, to understand it, and really truly enjoy it now in her own language.
I saw your mom at church a few months ago, and she was very nice to me and expressed her appreciation for the work that we did. A few people share similar feelings when they meet me, and it's really gratifying.
I I'm sure it makes you feel good to know that even though it was a challenge, I'm sure, to translate, there's people out there that appreciate what you have done. So again, I guess I want to shift gears again and focus on your experience growing up deaf with deaf parents and in a totally deaf family, and including attending schools for the deaf. All of the listeners to this radio program can obviously hear. And so I want to ask you to share with us your experience in schools for the deaf and including Gallaudet University.
Okay, well, my experience at deaf schools while I was growing up was probably different than most other deaf students at the time because I was a day student. I commuted from home back to school, and I never lived in the dorms. I was able to live at home or either ride my bike or walk to school because it wasn't that far. In fact, my father taught at the school, so we lived in the same town. Most of my friends, though, lived at the dorms, and I really feel like I missed out on that opportunity. They had a lot of fun during the night. They would get together every night after dinner and have fun while I was at home. In fact, I was not allowed to come over during the evenings to play with my friends in the dorms because I was home with my family. It was hard because all of my friends were at school, and I didn't have any friends at my house, so it was strange.
So was it your parents or the school that didn't allow you to come back to school at night?
Well, it was the school that wouldn't allow me to come back. After a while, though, they began to change the rule, and the school allowed my younger brothers and sisters to go to school in the evening, and they were much more involved than I was. But for me, attending deaf school was like typical public school. The only exception was that all my teachers signed. The things I learned in my school were the same as hearing students learned in their schools. I really learned a lot and was able to progress and grow. I still remember things from, like, the second and third grade. My teachers were great teachers. I remember one teacher I really liked that she loved horses and taught us all about them. So I learned all about horses and the different breeds and the different gaits and trots and gallops and so on. It's funny the silly things that you remember, but it was because of the excellent teachers I had. So that was my experience growing up. Now, focusing on sound and some of the uses of sound, there's a book titled Deaf in America that has a good chapter in that book. I think it's chapter 6, and I use that book a lot when I teach ASL. The book in the chapter explained the different perspectives on sound. For example, I remember when I was in school, we would have track practice, or it was cross country. I think it was track. Anyway, when we were done, a group of us girls would go and shower, and we had big open showers. The walls and the floors were all wet, and because of that, it was a really good place to make noise. We found through the experience that the water was really good at carrying sound, and it was really cool. We could yell, specifically if we yelled into the corners of the wet walls. So for us, the louder the yelling meant the deeper the sound. We weren't as good as the boys were. They could get the sound so loud that you could, like, feel it. You have to understand, we didn't hear anything with our ears. We were feeling it, the vibrations in our chest. We girls would only do that every once in a while, but the boys would do it all the time, every day. We would yell in the showers in the dorms, and I missed out on the yelling in all the dorms because I wasn't there. If you look at it from the perspective of a person who could hear, they would think of that and view that as just awful behavior. But we weren't yelling for any real purpose. We were just yelling for no reason, just because it was fun. We would just scream, ah, and that was it. Our view or our perspective of sound was the deepness of it. We like the boom, like a bass sound. That is why we relate to rhythm. We like the sounds with a strong rhythm. Like pianos and trumpets and other instruments like that don't really appeal to the deaf because it's hard to feel the rhythm. We do, however, like drums, electric guitars, and instruments that have a strong bass rhythm. Our school cheers, in fact, would be based on rhythm. It's very common to have like a three-part rhythm, one, two, three. Or a famous deaf rhythm is one, two, three, like this. That is basically what I discussed in my deaf music workshop, or maybe we could call it deaf rap. Who knows? Our school cheers were usually based on those rhythms. When I went to Gallaudet, the fight song had a little different rhythm. It went like this. Everyone, or at least almost everyone seemed to love the rhythm of that song and of the president's song. I've discovered that many deaf schools have fight songs that are based on similar rhythms. Now what I'm trying to do is simply to apply that rhythm to a storytelling. Huh. I love telling stories to children, not so much to adults, but telling children's stories. The only problem is that the rhythm is a better fit with adults because children don't quite understand it yet. I really enjoy telling stories. Do you want me to show you an example of a story?
Yes, please.
Okay, it goes like this. Now, time, story, story, story. Story, what, bear, bear, bear. There, house, tree, tree, tree. So you see, you start with the rhythm, one, two, one, two, three, and I try to enjoy being creative and matching the stories to the rhythm. I have performed that story about three times, and the response seems pretty positive. I'm trying to get the message out to the mainstream. In fact, if you watch old deaf films, you'll see that they have and did use rhythm. I could go on and on about the history and all that's involved, but basically, rhythm was used in the past, and then it's kind of stopped being used over time. One reason that happened was that the number of deaf schools has decreased, and deaf students are being mainstreamed into public schools. Another reason is that English has given the primary focus, and we have lost the traditions of our language. I'm trying to bring some of that back, and maybe even add some new ones. I think it's really fun.
That's great. If you're just joining us, I'm Rich Sutton, and I'm here interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and Kim Day is interpreting for Minnie Mae, who is deaf, and this is Everything Creative on the Mormon Channel. So you mentioned briefly the reduction in the number of deaf schools and more mainstream enrollment of deaf students in public schools and things like that, and a greater focus on the English. What are your feelings about all of that?
Well, I think there are pros and cons to both sides of that issue. I was mainstreamed in the public school during the last 3 years of high school, and I learned a lot from that, and it was beneficial for me. I think that I did so well because I already had a good foundation from growing up in the deaf school, and I already had my identity established. I have seen many children, though, who grew up mainstream their whole lives in the public school, and they don't have any identity or know who they are as a deaf person. There are a lot of children who miss out on a lot of things growing up mainstream, such as social skills. This happens because they miss out on so much while growing up. We need to accept ASL and English both. Yes, English is important, but we need both languages. Some public schools have large groups of deaf students, and I think that's fine. But most public schools have only one or two deaf students in the entire school, and they're all alone and lost in a sea of hearing people. For deaf people, their, for lack of a better word, disability, is not a physical thing. Yes, it affects their ears, but their disability or their struggle that they face is not a physical one, but it's a lack of communication. If you cannot communicate, how are you supposed to learn? And how do you develop your own identity and your own self-esteem? How do you develop relationships? The list goes on and on.
That's true, and thank you so much for sharing that. Your focus was mostly on your experience at a deaf school while you're growing up. I'm curious to learn a little bit more about your experience at Gallaudet when you're in college. I'm sure there weren't many of the members of the church there, and I'm curious, what was your experience with the church and going to Gallaudet and things like that?
Well, for me, coming from Idaho, a small town of only 3,000 people, a deaf school that only had 115 students, say, and the public high school had about 350 students, so
wow,
it's pretty small. Then going to Gallaudet, where there were over 2,000 students, it was a big change. During my first 2 years at Gallaudet, I kind of got lost. I got really involved socially and got too busy on Sundays with going places and studying and being involved in so many different things. My first year, I played around a lot and did a lot of different things. But by my sophomore year, I got involved with the SBG, the Student Body Government, and I was the director of student welfare. Some of my duties included cafeteria policies, parking, and other things that affected the lives of the students. During my junior year, I became the editor of the school paper, and I really loved that.
Huh. What was the name of the newspaper?
The Buff and the Blue. It was the school colors. Being the editor of the newspaper was fun for me. Then during my senior year, I became an RA, the head RA for the dorms, and I was also involved on the yearbook staff. So I was involved in so many different things during my years at Gallaudet. I really didn't go to church much during those first 2 years, but I did attend regularly during my last 2 years. And yes, you're right, there were not many members of the church there. In fact, I think there were only 5 of us at the beginning that were LDS, that at least the ones I knew of. But that number increased from my freshman year to my senior year. So during my senior year, a group was started, the LDSSA, and I was one of the co-founders of that organization at Gallaudet. By the time I graduated, we had about 35 members who were involved in the LDSSA. It was too bad that I graduated by the time they got a bigger group. We were able to carpool for transportation back and forth to church, which we did not have during my first 2 years. So during those first 2 years, I had to have a member of the branch come and pick me up and drive me back to church and then drive me back to school. And it was kind of awkward. And sometimes they would come to pick me up and we would miss out on our timing and then it would all be for nothing. Or some of the students wouldn't show up and it was just kind of a tough situation. But during my junior and senior year, it was really good after we established the LDSSA. I have heard that the number of LDS students has gone way down, and now it's just a small group again. But they do have an Institute of Religion there now, which is great. We didn't have that during my time, except starting my senior year, we had an institute teacher who would come maybe teach us about once a week.
If you're just joining us, this is the Mormon Channel and Everything Creative, and I'm Rich Sutton. I'm here interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and we have with us Kim Day, who's interpreting for her because she's deaf. There's one thing that I've noticed at deaf schools throughout the country in Gallaudet, and that's the fact that sports is so important in the deaf community. And I'm curious why you think that is.
Well, I think it's just because sports are important, period. It's a way for us to get together and socialize with each other. As an example of that, when I go to a basketball game or a tournament, I never end up watching the game. I'm always talking and chatting with all the people that I know who are there. If you were to look at the audience, they rarely watch the games. The only exception would be if it was my team that was playing. Then maybe I would watch. Maybe. So really, I think it's more of a social thing than a sports or athletic thing. If you think about it, we don't get together in many other settings, and we don't get together for music or dances. It's not to say that we don't like dances. We do, but we just don't get together as a group for that. The theater is great, and we like to get together for that, but there's only a few places that have deaf theater, maybe California, Chicago, New York, places like that. So sports are a really important way for us in the deaf community to get together. If you go to a political conference like the NAD, their biannual conference, usually you will see about 2,000 people attend. However, you take the bowling tournament, which happens every year, and you might see 7,000 to 10,000 people attend.
Wow.
Bowling is big. The same applies to both softball, basketball. Those are both really popular. And usually you'll get 3,000 or 4,000 or even 5,000 people to show up every year. It's a good place and a good way to get together and socialize. People will save their money, set up carpools just to get to these events. It's really important for us in the deaf community.
When in your life have you felt creative, and what in your life makes you feel creative?
I think I feel the most creative when I'm trying to think of the stories in ASL and matching the rhythm that we talked about. I really enjoy that, and I feel creative when I do that, and it's probably the only creative art I have. In any other way, I'm not really artistically inclined.
Me neither.
Often when I teach ASL, I have to be creative. Students will ask how I would sign a specific sentence or phrase, and I will sign something, or maybe I sign something they don't understand, and I don't tell them the word. Instead, I try to think of creative ways to describe the word without telling them what it is. Sometimes we would just try for a while, and then finally I just have to give in and tell them what the word is, because some words are just too hard and to try to explain it. Say, for example, the word abstract. I could sign the word abstract and then try to explain what abstract is. I would knock on my desk to show something tangible and say it's not that. But that would be just too hard and it wouldn't make sense. So I would just tell them what the word is. But there are other signs that I can't think of right now that could cause me to be creative in how I describe what the sign is. I really enjoy being creative while I was teaching ASL, and I really did feel creative in those moments.
I'm Rich Sutton, and this is the Mormon Channel, and you're listening to Everything Creative. And I'm interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, who is deaf, and Kim Day is here interpreting for her. So do you find yourself being creative with your kids, kind of staying on this creative topic? Do you use deaf music and your stories with them to be creative?
I don't like to.
Why not? Because you're their mom or?
Well, because they're too young and the rhythm thing doesn't make sense to them yet. I taught a workshop about deaf music to a group of youth, and it seemed that there were some who showed interest, but other kids acted like, so what? After the workshop was over, I asked my three kids what they thought of the workshop, and they all said it was boring. There are other workshops. There were other workshops before mine that was about mime, and that was much more exciting to them than mine was. It seems that the rhythm and the deaf music is a better fit for adults.
So do you think it's because the adults have gone through deaf schools or maybe other situations where they've had experience with deaf music and the rhythm that deaf people enjoy?
I don't know. Some of the adults never went to the deaf school, and more now they are from a mainstream background, so I don't really know why. I'll have to look into it and analyze it some more, but I haven't found an answer yet.
That's really interesting. Okay, so you grew up with eight siblings who are all deaf, and you have three kids who are all deaf. So does that mean that your extended family, such as nieces and nephews and everything, are all deaf as well? Or are there some in your family who can hear? I think that'd be really interesting.
Yes, there are nine children, and we're all deaf. I have 16 nieces and nephews, including my own four children. Only four of those can hear. All four of them are siblings and can hear because their mom married a man who can hear. It's always made me wonder about them being able to hear and the rest of us being deaf. Even though we are all deaf, there are varying levels of deafness in our family. With my three kids, the oldest is really hard of hearing. Let me go off subject for a minute and talk about the term hard of hearing. From the perspective of a person who can hear, hard of hearing means deaf. It literally means a person who you might have a hard time communicating with or someone that you have to yell at or speak up loudly to. But from the deaf perspective, hard of hearing means that the person can hear or can hear pretty well.
That's a really interesting explanation of the two different perspectives or two different sides of it.
When we're discussing hearing loss, we are coming from the perspective of a deaf person. So a deaf person has deafness at the center of their perspective. Then being hard of hearing is considered by a deaf person to be more towards being able to hear than to being deaf. A person who is hard of hearing can hear, can probably talk on the phone, and probably speak pretty well. Now, from the perspective of a person who can hear, a person who is hard of hearing is considered more towards being deaf or like a person who can't hear. Anyway, back to my point. My oldest daughter is hard of hearing and can hear pretty well. The other two are totally deaf like me. My brother, who has three kids as well, also has one child who is hard of hearing and the other two are deaf. I have a sister who has two children. One is hard of hearing and the other is deaf. And even though there is a variety of hearing loss, 12 are considered deaf and 4 would be considered hearing. The 4 hearing nieces and nephews can't sign very well because their mom can speak well enough and is also hard of hearing. It is an example of exactly what I was saying. Even though I said that all of my 8 siblings are deaf, some are hard of hearing and have a variety of hearing losses, but all are culturally deaf and some can speak. My sister, who I mentioned before, she speaks with her kids, and that's why they don't sign very well. However, they all can sign well enough to communicate with their cousins.
So that's interesting. I guess really interesting for me because I was raised as a CODA, a child of deaf adults. There's times in my life where I can remember I felt like I was living in between two worlds. Like I didn't completely belong in a world that can hear or in the deaf world, just kind of somewhere in between. I could sign, but I could also hear. So it's interesting the many different situations that result as in the deaf community. You know, for me, my parents are both deaf, but don't have the genes to pass on deafness to future generations. So now in my life, I can hear, both of my kids can hear, and my wife can hear. So I guess it's just interesting for me to see the different situations of people in the deaf community.
Well, that makes me think of how it was different for me growing up in an all-deaf family. There is a small group of us, only about 8 to 10% of us. Most deaf people are born and raised by parents who can hear, and most deaf children are usually the only person in their family who is deaf. Whereas in my family, all of us were deaf and all of us signed. I have noticed a few differences from that. For example, if I fell down and started crying, my mom wasn't going to come to me. I had to go looking for her first, and then I would start crying. In a family where everyone can hear, if the kid falls down and starts crying, they can stay right where they're at, and the parents will come running and get them and hold them. It was different in my family, and probably same for you. If you fell, your parents weren't going to come hear you, wouldn't hear you, and they wouldn't come.
It's the same for me.
We couldn't call each other either by yelling. We would have to turn on and off the lights or walk over to get their attention.
Or my favorite, pound on the table.
That's right. Or pounding on the table. Or go into another room to get their attention. Another example would be the doorbell. In a house where people can hear, the doorbell can be heard clearly in every room, even in the bathroom. But in a deaf house, the lights flash on and off when the doorbell rings. And sometimes we're in a room without the light, so we don't know that someone's knocking at the door and never go answer the door.
That's so interesting. So we've talked a lot about the differences between hearing culture and deaf culture and about being deaf. And now I kind of want to just focus and talk about you. I want to know what's your driving force and what motivates you in your life. I guess what makes you move forward?
I think it's my family and my children. You asked me earlier how I am creative with my kids. What I try to do is to be creative with things like family home evening. I try to do something fun every week, like a small outing. It doesn't often happen, but I try to focus on what my kids are doing. For example, my daughter loves photography, and her pictures are really good. She's also excels when it comes to writing, so I try to encourage her with her writing. Now she is struggling with school like everyone else her age, and I try to encourage her to find something that she likes to do so she can be excited and motivate herself. My son, the middle child, is fascinated by school, especially science. That is my favorite subject, too, because my dad taught science for 37 years, and I grew up with science. So whenever we are driving, I try to point out different rock formations in the mountains and ask my kids why they look that way, and it makes my kids think about it. So I encourage my kids to use their heads and try to analyze things in the world around them. Huh. My youngest daughter, Isabel, is still pretty young, and she's the clown and loves to be silly. My husband is involved in making movies, and I enjoy watching him do that and supporting him. My thing is making Christmas ornaments every year. We all get together as a family and find things to make as ornaments, and we paint them. And that is something that we do creative together every year. This year, I'm hoping to have a big Halloween bash. I want to involve the kids in finding things and planning it, and I guess we better get started soon.
It's true. If you're just joining us, this is Everything Creative on the Mormon Channel, and I'm Rich Sutton, and I'm interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and she's deaf, and Kim Day is here interpreting for her. There's going to be many people in the deaf community who will watch this interview, and also many people who can hear will listen to this interview on the radio. I'm curious, what would you like to share with all of the people that will watch or listen to this interview?
Maybe I can share a story that will help illustrate what I want to say. Being raised in a deaf family, having gone to a deaf school, gone to deaf church, it wasn't a branch yet, it was just a group, but having some interaction with people who can hear, I never really fully understood people who could hear. I always felt different. But then when I got to high school, I decided to transfer to a public high school, and I was terrified. I was all alone. I didn't know anyone. For about the first 3 months, it was just me and my books. I would walk around with my head down, go back and forth to class, watch the interpreter, and leave as soon as class was over. Huh. But then some of the girls in my class began writing notes to each other, and that continued for a while. And that's when I realized that people who could hear were normal, that they were just like me. That's a story I often share with my students in ASL classes because I want people to understand that we're all normal. It doesn't matter where we were raised, whether on a farm or in a city or a big town or a small town. It doesn't matter if our skin is different colors, if we have a different religion, or if we have a disability. We are all normal. We're all the same. And our internal needs, desires, motivations, our desires for relationships, that's all the same.
I think it's so fascinating how you talked about realizing that people who could hear were normal. I've had the same experience with people who can hear meeting a deaf person for the first time, so kind of the reverse. And they have the same experience and come to a realization that deaf people are normal. And so it's just so fascinating to hear the reverse side of it. And maybe people who can hear wouldn't think that deaf people consider them different and abnormal. Once we interact with others, we realize we are all the same and yet all unique at the same time.
That's right. For many people who are deaf that are raised in families that can hear, their experience was completely different than mine. My experience with people who can hear was more limited while I was growing up. Many deaf people feel different when they grow up in a family that can hear. I felt normal. I had to go a really long way out of my comfort zone to relate to people who could hear. But that experience has helped me with my relationships today. For example, when I teach my classes in ASL, I see them as normal and I can relate to them.
That's true. So as you are well aware, in most languages, maybe all except signing, the translator or interpreter translates or interprets, and the people who read or listen never know who the translator or interpreter is. But for you, obviously it's different because people actually can see you. And I'm curious if people who meet you recognize you.
Well, really, many people don't recognize me. Huh. It will take someone telling them who I am, and then they're shocked to realize that it's me. People just don't recognize me, so it's not frequent that people come up to me. But also, I feel like when you are watching the person on the screen, that's really not me, because the spirit was involved, and that helped so much that I have to feel that I don't have to feel completely responsible. But don't get me wrong, it was a big responsibility, and I have to be careful of what I do and what I say, but I'm not perfect. I don't want to have people be turned off by the Book of Mormon because of something I have done or if I've offended them. Most of the time, it doesn't bother me too much because I know that the Spirit was there.
If you're just joining us, this is the Mormon Channel, and you're listening to Everything Creative. I'm Rich Sutton, and I'm here interviewing Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, and her words are being interpreted by Kim Day. Do you have any special spiritual experiences or anything that you'd like to share with us about your experience in translating the Book of Mormon? Anything that comes to your mind in particular? I'm really curious about that.
Well, yes, maybe in the beginning, the translation is a very technical and kind of tedious process, but generally you look at a phrase and you know how to translate it. But there were some special experiences. During the chapters of 2 Nephi, specifically the Isaiah chapters, it was really hard. I would always pray before we started translating, and even sometimes if I was struggling with a particular translation, I would pray again, and then everything would work out. It was never a big inspiration or a vision or anything, but it was more of a daily kind of working at it.
Huh. Okay, let me be more specific, and maybe that'll help with the question. Were there any specific words or sentences or phrases that you had to really work with or that you struggled with?
Yes, there were words like the word revelation. There are many signs that members of the church have used for a long time, but they're based on the English rules. So I had to think if that was accurate or not in ASL. Sometimes I had to break from tradition and sign it a different way. For example, I had to change the sign for revelation that has been established based on the English rules, but keep the meaning in ASL that God was informing man instead of God and man were talking to each other. There were a few things like that, and we had lots of tools to help us. If the tools didn't answer our questions, there were people who we could call, and they could help me with some of the questions or difficulties. I cannot think of a specific example right now, but we had two wonderful committees. One was the Language Review Committee, and the other was the Ecclesiastical Review Committee. And they were there to review my work and make sure it was done correctly.
So there's another thing that I want to ask, but it's kind of on a personal track, so just bear with me. As you know, my dad grew up in Idaho and attended the school for the deaf there that your father taught at. And while I was growing up, my dad always talked about your father. In fact, my dad loves science because of your father and his teaching my dad. And I remember always looking up to you as I was growing up because of the things I heard from my dad. And I would just personally love to hear your testimony.
I know you probably hear people say this all the time, but the foundation of my testimony is that I know Jesus Christ performed the atonement for me. I felt when I was growing up that Jesus performed the atonement for all of us. But what about for me, Minnie Mae? That I didn't know until later when I was converted, despite having been raised in the church. That part of my testimony has helped and influenced everything else. Once I knew that he had a personal knowledge of me, of my needs, of my thoughts, and my concerns, I could do what I needed to do. For example, when I was working on the Book of Mormon, I felt that he knew what I was doing and what I needed, and that I needed help. And that specific sentence or that specific word, he was always there answering me. With my own kids, I'm still learning how to work with them. Every time I lose my keys, and I lose them a lot, he knows where my keys are. Not where every random person's keys are, but where my keys are, and I always find them. And I have a personal testimony of that. I have a testimony of tithing, and I have a testimony of Joseph Smith. I know he is a prophet. I know that because of the time in my life when I was a gospel doctrine teacher for several years. I remember one specific lesson on Joseph Smith, and I asked myself if I really knew he was a prophet. I prayed about it, I studied my lesson, and while I was teaching, I knew. I have a testimony of our current prophet, Thomas S. Monson. I feel like I know him because of all the other prophets, I didn't know them as apostles, but I felt like I have known President Monson as an apostle, and now he's our prophet. It's a great experience to see him as our prophet, and somehow I feel like I know him.
I just want to personally thank you for giving us some of your time for this interview and for our discussion. To be honest, I really don't even care that there's other people out there who will listen or watch this, because I've really enjoyed sitting here and talking with you and asking you questions and being able to hear your answers. I've really, really enjoyed this time with you and want to thank you for your time. And the sacrifice that you've made for the entire deaf community. I'm sure few people realize how many hours and days, weeks and months and years you sacrificed to work on the Book of Mormon, temple projects, other books and magazines, and so many other things that they could have those things translated. You've sacrificed so much, and for that I just want to say thank you. And if I can, just include everyone else that would want to add their expressions of appreciation as well. Again, thank you for listening or watching this interview. My name is Rich Sutton, and I've been here with Minnie Mae Wilding Diaz, who is deaf, and also Kim Day, who has been interpreting for her. And we want to thank both of them for their time. Thank you for listening to Everything Creative on the Mormon Channel. To view this interview in sign language, visit our website at radio.lds.org.